Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents America's Forgotten Army, the true story of the U.S. 7th Army in World War II, and an unknown battle that changed history. By Charles Whiting. Narrated by Graham Rowett. Introduction. Silent cannons, soon cease your silence. Soon unlimbered to begin the red business. Walt Whitman, Drum Tap. All this long day of July 9, 1943, the storm has raged, whipping the Mediterranean into a wild white fury. The great fleet of transports and escorts wallowed up and down in the tossing green waves, their bows taking tons of angry white water every time they struck the sea. By mid-afternoon, the 80,000 men of the U.S. invasion were deadly sick and not a little afraid. Clinging to the ladders, stanchions, and poop decks of heaving, plunging transports, their faces were a sickly, sweaty green as they retched and vomited miserably. The invasion fleet, it seemed, was in serious trouble. Tough veteran Admiral Henry Hewitt, who was in command on his flagship, the Monrovia, definitely thought so. Late on that same afternoon, as a full gale raged, buffeting the big vessel like blows from some gigantic fist, he went looking for General Patton, who would lead the invasion force on the morrow. "George," he said when he found him, facing up to the tall, graying three-star general, "this shows every sign of becoming more intense. I think I'll signal Ike and Cunningham to delay the landings." Apparently unaffected by the ship's heaving and tossing, Patton said, "Wait a minute, Henry. Have you spoken to Steer?" Lieutenant Commander Steer was an aerologist who the previous year had restored Patton's faith in the science of meteorology and the United States Navy during another huge storm that broke just as Patton had sailed in to invade North Africa. Now Patton regarded the hard-pressed naval scientist as something of a good luck charm. "Yes," Hewitt replied. "Did he say how long this goddamn storm will last?" Patton queried. "Well," Hewitt said, "he thinks it will calm down by D-Day." Steer's prediction gave Patton new hope. He sent for the lieutenant commander. "Well, Houdini?" Patton demanded, calling the naval officer by the nickname he had given him back in November 1942. "What do you say?" "This is the Mistral, sir," Steer answered, referring to the brisk north wind. "Violent but abrupt, I would say it will moderate by 2200 and the weather will be fine by H hour, General." Patton gave him a hard look. "It had better," he rasped. Steer was confident. "I'm positive, sir," he answered. At 10 o'clock that night, the full gale still raged, but then Houdini's prediction came right, only 30 minutes behind schedule. Half an hour later, the wind began to ease. Slowly but surely, fire-green heaving sea calmed down, and the miserable seasick soldiers who littered the vomit-stained decks of the transports started to realize that they were not going to die after all. Not just yet, at least. At midnight, when the Monrovia's radar scope picked up the pear-shaped outline of the island of Sicily, their objective off the coast of Italy, the wind had died away almost altogether. It was Patton's hour of glory. Hastily, Patton's staff, plodding General Lucas, one-eyed General Gay, dashing Colonel Codman, assembled on the bridge deck, and Patton, now commanding general of the first real American army in Europe in World War II, made a little speech to the officers who would follow him over the next 2 years. "Gentlemen," he said in that curiously high-pitched voice of his, "it's now 1 minute past midnight, July 9th, 10th, 1943, and I have the honor and privilege to activate the 7th United States Army. This is the first army in history to be activated after midnight, and baptized in blood before daylight." Admiral Hewitt signaled to his flag lieutenant. In marched a smart, precise honor guard. With them, they bore the U.S. Navy's gift to Patton, a brand new flag for a new army. Blue, yellow, and red silk bearing the letter A for Army. Thus, as Patton began to cry a little, the U.S. 7th Army was activated on the high seas, with the invasion of Sicily only 2.5 hours away. Observing the scene at that historic moment, Commander Britton, USN, could see the fire of pride in Patton's glistening eyes. It seemed to the naval officer that it was to him, Patton, not a ship's deck he stood upon, but a peak of glory. Now, the first American army to fight on European soil in World War II got off to a good start. The plan had envisaged the American new boys playing the role of a mere flank guard to Bernard Montgomery's veterans of the British 8th Army. "Get your knees down, Yank!" the bronzed veterans of 2 years of desert warfare had sneered when they had first seen the pale-faced soldiers of the 7th. Patton changed all that. He wasn't going to let that little fart, Monty, relegate his new army to a sideshow. Under Patton's dynamic, aggressive leadership, the 7th surged through Sicily like shit through a goose, to use another of Patton's favorite expressions. That July, Patton's 7th Army was in the headlines all the time. Patton drives for Palermo. Patton's 7th takes Troina, the banner headlines back home screamed. Patton takes Messina. Patton forces Sicily's surrender. Then came tragedy. After that notorious slapping incident, Patton fell from grace, and with him his beloved 7th Army. While he brooded in his gloomy Palazzo HQ in Sicily, unit after unit of his 7th was taken from him and fed into the 5th Army of his hated rival, General Clark, in Italy. By the winter of 1943-1944, the 7th was less than 5,000 HQ troops, a mere token force. Already, it seemed that the U.S. 7th Army had become America's forgotten army. It was a year before this forgotten army went into action again. Merely 3 divisions strong now, it landed off the coast of southern France in August 1944. It was a landing that the British strongly opposed as a sideshow, a weakening of Allied strength, with no real strategic purpose behind it. Indeed, British Prime Minister Churchill had once threatened to resign if it were not called off. American commanders, such as General Clark in Italy, too felt it diverted from what he believed should be the Allies' main effort, naturally in his own theater of operations. The landing was relatively unopposed. At a cost of 3,000 casualties in a month-long campaign, the 7th Army punched right through southern France to join up with Patton's 3rd in Lorraine by September. Critics of the 7th thought it had been all too easy. They called it, with a sneer, the Champagne Campaign. While the 7th had been going through France virtually unnoticed by the general back home, Omar Bradley's armies in the north had been hitting the headlines as they raced for the border of the Reich. The new commander of the 7th, General Alexander Sandy Patch, was indeed a brave, competent combat soldier, but he was no Patton. He had little charisma and could not provide that exciting copy for the news hounds, which profane, dramatic, old blood and guts could. The 7th continued to remain forgotten. It was no different in January 1945 when the 7th was attacked in what Hitler codenamed Operation Northwind, an 8-division-strong German assault in French Alsace-Lorraine. There, Patch's 7th fought a desperate, touch-and-go 2nd Battle of the Bulge. But that month-long battle was totally overshadowed by the dramatic events further north in the Belgian Ardennes. Even today, when virtually every aspect of World War II in Europe has been extensively written about, made the subject of movies, TV films, and the theme of 100 novels, the 7th's fight to save Alsace during Operation Northwind is totally unknown. It was the same 2 months later when the Allies crossed the Rhine. Every student of military history, and most of the general public, too, is aware of that dramatic seizure of the railroad bridge at Remagen during the first week of March 1945, the most important bridge in the world. Patton's surprise crossing at Oppenheim is familiar, too.
"Brad, don't tell anyone, but I'm across," he yelled over the telephone to his boss, Bradley, carried away by his own triumph in beating that little fart, Montgomery, over the river by a day.
But who has ever heard of the 7th's crossing 3 weeks after that celebrated attack at Remagen? Indeed, the only incident worthy of remembering of the 7th's assault on the Rhine was that one white NCO and 9 black soldiers of the French division attached to the 7th made their own lone crossing in a rubber dinghy. Of all the hundreds of thousands of Allied troops who finally crossed, those 10 were the only ones to have a memorial erected to that feat. It is still there. Naturally, they assaulted the Rhine in their own unique fashion on April 1, 1945. April Fool's Day. Even the final surrender of 1 million German soldiers to the victorious 6th Army Group, to which the 7th belonged, was marred by the fact that their French comrades-in-arms continued to fight the enemy because they were jealous they had not been represented at the surrender negotiations. In the end, the French, a constant pain in the neck to the American 7th, gave up their private war for lack of Germans to fight. Anyway, what did it matter? The massive surrender of German troops to the 7th was completely upstaged by that little fart Montgomery high up in North Germany. One day before the 7th's surrender went into operation, he had bagged the whole of the German Army, Navy, Air Force, and what was left of the battered Nazi state, including its last Führer. To the very end, the U.S. 7th Army seemed involved in sideshows, forgotten by the media. By VE Day 1945, the 7th had achieved its victory in Europe at a cost of 15,271 dead, 58,342 wounded, plus twice that number of non-battle casualties between August 1944 and June 1945. Now it seemed about to pass into history. In the years to come, veterans of the campaign in the ETO would be able to say proudly, when they were asked what they had done in the big war in Europe, "Why, I served with Patton's 3rd, or Hodges 1st, perhaps, or even Big Simp Simpson's 9th. You know, the general who looked like an Indian chief with his shaven skull." The replies were a kind of proud shorthand, and their listeners would know what they were talking about immediately. They had fought at D-Day, raced for the Reich's frontiers, held at Bastogne, slogged it out in the Hürtgen, jumped the Rhine, and had almost reached Berlin. But what did Patch's 7th Army stand for? Where had it served? What had it done?
"The U.S. 7th Army? Never heard of it."
As the years passed after World War II, the deeds of the 7th Army became mere footnotes to the brave, bold accounts of other U.S. armies. They had fought in sideshows, minor campaigns in exotic places like Sicily, the Riviera, Austria, which had not had much effect on the course of the war. After working on it for 40 years, the U.S. Department of Defense did not produce its long-promised official history of the 7th Army, from the Riviera to the Rhine, until 1993. That must be significant in itself. Truly a forgotten army. On Friday, December 15, 1944, the 7th Army's 45th Thunderbird Division was the first of its outfits to cross the German frontier. They entered Germany at the little Saar hamlet called Bobenthal, but they would soon be chased out of the place, and it would be another 3 months before they saw it again. But on that Friday afternoon, with the sky already darkening and the guns rumbling in the distance, the GIs flopped down in the mud and rested. There were cold rations out of a can,
but there was a mail call which made the weary infantrymen's day, for some of them had been fighting and away from home for 2 years now. A platoon commander came up and told the men squatting in the cold mud that it was an historic moment. They were the first of the 7th soldiers to enter Hitler's Reich. The GIs were not particularly impressed, but they might have been if that young 2nd Louis had informed them that the same 7th Army to which they belonged would still be in Germany nearly 50 years later. Never in their wildest dreams could those infantrymen of so long ago have imagined that their sons, and their sons too, would serve in the 7th as well, that their own 2nd Louis and chicken captains, if they survived, would one day be colonels, perhaps even generals, commanding the same 7th Army. But it would come true, all of it. First came the victory of 1945, and the job of tackling the appalling ruins of the Third Reich, which Hitler had boasted would last 1,000 years, but which fell apart in exactly 12 years, 4 months, and 9 days. Those were the days of Fraulein's and non-fraternization, the runaway VD epidemic among the troops, black market re-education, the Nuremberg trials in that same city where the year before the 45th Division had slogged it out for 6 days with fanatical Nazis. For a while, there was no water, gas, or electricity. Communications had broken down completely. The 7th had 1 million prisoners to deal with, millions of displaced persons and wandering refugees from 12 European countries. Somehow, the 7th Army coped and helped to get Germany started again. When the Cold War commenced, the 7th Army tackled it with its huge infrastructure sprawling right across Germany from the border with East Germany and Czechoslovakia over the Rhine into France. To the casual visitor to the Army in those days, it must have seemed that the 7th's soldiers led a good life. They served in refurbished Kasernen, or barracks, built by Hitler and now named after the American heroes of the Old War, Robinson, Rose, and Patch. Their families lived segregated from the Germans in the ghettos of base housing, complete with PX, snack bars, movie theaters, bowling alleys, and rod and gun clubs. U.S. provincial life transported wholesale 3,000 miles across the Atlantic into Germany. No wonder the Germans called these places scornfully Little America. For the single soldier, there was cheap sex aplenty. The callow young draftees now had the choice of B-girls from the tawdry GI bars who seemed mostly to be spying for the Russians, or the roadside whores who worked from trailers, or even in the bushes of roads leading out of town, charging $5 a dance. No wonder the GIs called them, with grim humor, Veronica Dankeschön, in other words, Veronica Thank Yous, a name which could be reduced to the forbidding initials VD. And if the Fraulein's didn't suffice, there was always a 3-day pass to the then Gay Paris and Pig Alley, Place Pigalle. But behind the superficially good life that the U.S. 7th Army led in the late 50s and 60s, there hovered all the while the threat just over that silent, sinister frontier, which always seemed so strangely deserted, but wasn't. All of them knew, even the dumbest private of the 7th Army, that at any moment the balloon might go up, and that Red Force, as the enemy was always known in the annual fall maneuvers, might instantly be replaced by the real thing, the Red Army. Occasionally, someone from the world, as the draftees longingly called the USA, would publicize the role these thousands of young American soldiers were playing in far-off Germany. Somewhere about 1959, a slack-hipped, loose-lipped private first class, Elvis Presley, made his appearance in the 7th in the unlikely role of a scout for the 3rd Armored Division. The world press went wild. The reporters, eager for a story, never learned, of course, that PFC Presley was driven to his barracks in the morning by a chauffeur in a white BMW, and that he lived in a private house at a rental of $800 a month, four times the going rate. But for a while, at least, the folks back home became aware that they had a huge army in Germany. 2 years later, the wall went up. Suddenly, America realized that it had, and vitally needed, an army in Germany. Vice President Johnson flew to Berlin and threw the western part of the city into a tizzy by demanding the shoe shops should be opened on Saturday afternoon. In Germany, all stores are closed on Saturday afternoons, save for the first Saturday in the month. Johnson felt, for some strange reason, that it was his first priority in this grave crisis to buy a pair of shoes for his outsize feet. President Kennedy followed and told the cheering populace in a great speech that, "I am a donut. Ich bin ein Berliner." The crowd cheered even more. At that moment of grave crisis, there were those who demanded that armored divisions should break through to West Berlin as a show of strength. But wiser heads at 7th Army's HQ prevailed and prevented the Cold War from turning into a very hot one indeed. But once the situation had cooled down, the 7th Army again lapsed into its usual obscurity. Once more, the forgotten army. Again, the dreary routine of guarding the border, practicing the defense of the Fulda Gap, going off on those back-breaking annual maneuvers at muddy Grafenwöhr, trying to keep control of an army plagued by boredom, drugs, and outbreaks of racial tension, commenced. Then at the other side of the world, another hot war broke out in Vietnam, while back home, youth revolted against the army. Flower power turned into riot power. The 7th Army provided much of the manpower. These young Second Louis of the battle in France and Germany now were the generals commanding the divisions fighting in Vietnam. As for the younger officers when they returned to Germany, decorated now, sporting their Purple Hearts and combat infantrymen badges, more often than not, they were morose and not a little bitter. All their effort and sacrifice had meant nothing to the folks back home. Then Nam was over, and those embittered young men vanished to be replaced by the new professionals, for the draft was finished. Still, the job in Germany remained the same, patrolling the border, defending the Fulda Gap, maneuvers at Grafenwöhr. It was the same dreary, boring routine in a forgotten army preparing for a war that might come, but never did. 55 years after the 7th Thunderbirds first crossed the frontier into Hitler's Reich, the forgotten army was still fulfilling its traditional role. Then, suddenly, things began to happen in Central Europe. The wall crumbled. The Cold War died. As one intelligence officer told the press in that exciting year of 1989, the threat just went away. For nearly five decades, the Forgotten Army had fulfilled a vital role. It had helped to keep the Russians east of the Elbe, and at the same time, as NATO's major component, it had kept the alliance together. American strength on the ground and American willpower had convinced the waverers in Europe to keep on doing their bit. But what was to be the future role of this forgotten army now? By October 1990, Germany was no longer divided by the victorious powers of World War II. The hard fact was that NATO's fate and that of the 7th Army now rested with Germany. With the country reunited, Germany, it appeared, would soon rid itself of those one-time conquerors and occupiers who had become its allies. To most observers, it seemed that the future role of NATO and the 7th Army would be decided not by the Russians or the Americans, but by the Germans themselves. The days of the 7th Army were numbered, or so it appeared. With startling suddenness, after nearly a half of a century of armed peace, the 7th Army was alerted for action once again. A grave crisis had erupted in the Persian Gulf. By the end of 1990, half of the 7th Army and all of its armor had gone to the Middle East. There, commanded and directed by generals such as Norman Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell, who as young officers had spent years of their lives in that forgotten army in Germany, the men of the 7th helped to achieve a brilliant victory in a war of 100 hours. Vindication of all that hard slog, decade after decade, in faraway Germany. Now the fate of the 7th Army still hangs in the balance. It seems to the author that the time has come to relate the battle history of that force which did so much to win World War II and the victory in the Gulf so many decades later. The U.S. 7th. America's Forgotten Army. Charles Whiting. York, England, and Bleyolf, Germany. 1. Sicily. Baptism in Blood. July, August, 1943.
It is true, I suppose, that the Americans consider that we have led them up the garden path in the Mediterranean, but what a beautiful path it has proved to be. They have picked peaches here, nectarines here. How grateful they should be.
Winston Churchill, 1943. The great deception had started innocently enough, far away from the scene of the bloody battle to come. Indeed, nothing could have been more remote from combat than the sedate, silent rooms of the Junior Carlton Club in the heart of London's clubland in that winter of 1943, when the first tentative plans were laid. Over coffee that gray winter's afternoon, with the club's ancient waiters creaking back and forth and the fat gray barrage balloons floating in the sky outside like tethered elephants, the smart young officer from Naval Intelligence, Commander the Honorable Ewan Montague, listened attentively as the white-haired pathologist, who was perhaps the world's greatest authority in his field, answered his carefully phrased questions.
Death would probably result from a lowering of the person's temperature, especially if the man in question were to float by means of a life belt.
Sir Bernard Spilsbury lectured him in that pedantic manner of his. First he would fall unconscious. Death would occur several hours later. On and on the old man droned. Montague posed the key question. Would there be any outward signs of how the man had met his death, sir? Sir Bernard considered for a moment, a cup of thin, weak wartime coffee poised at his thin lips. He wasn't given to answering questions of that nature lightly. How many times in the past had the life of a man or woman accused of murder depended upon the answer he had given to the court in the Old Bailey just across the road?
No, he said finally. In my opinion, there would be no outward characteristics of the manner of death.
The young Royal Naval officer's heart skipped a beat. It was the answer he had been hoping for ever since that hush-hush intelligence organization, the XX Committee, that is, the Double Cross Committee, had first dreamed up Operation Mincemeat. All he needed now was the right body.
But you can't get bodies just for the asking.
Sir William Bentley Purchase, the coroner for the London borough of St. Pancras, objected pompously 1 week later.
I mean, even with bodies all over the place.
He meant the many air raid victims which that area of central London had suffered over the last months.
Each one has to be accounted for.
But the middle-aged knight, who affected spats and a wing collar, did not realize just how powerful the Double Cross Committee was, and how much depended on finding the right body in the icy Victorian vaults of St. Pancras Morgue. Discreet pressure was applied right from the very top, and that meant the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill himself. Sir William gave in. His bodies were available to his clever young officer, the product of both Cambridge and Harvard universities. Thus it was that Sir Bernard, Sir William, and Montague met behind the locked doors of St. Pancras Morgue.
A century after the last body snatcher had been arrested and imprisoned in that same London borough, the three men sat about finding the corpse that Montague needed so urgently for the great deception. In the harsh white light cast by the naked bulbs, they viewed a number of corpses laid out on slabs in the yellow-tiled Victorian House of Death. One by one, they were all rejected, save one.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?